I want to get back to the phone lines. I'm going to chat with Scott Kelly. He's got an incredibly interesting story to tell. Scott, good morning.
Good morning, Neil. How are you?
I'm good, man. I'm good. Can I ask you a question? Do you visit prisoners in prison now?
I do. Groups, like, yeah.
Okay. Why?
It's a good question. It's not something that I would have seen myself or wanted to do at one point in time. But it feels very natural. I think it's very important for people that have come out the other side of something and learned from it to give back. Not that you have to give back, not that you need to give back. You're entitled to move on and get on with your life. But I get a lot of, it's a heart thing for me. Like I like sitting in places with people that are in places that I've been and in hardship that I've been. And I think there's a very... It's a very important thing that happens, and I get a lot from it.
Okay, and I'm quite sure that they do as well, considering the fact that when you're sitting with them, you say, I've also been in prison, I've been in this prison itself, right? If we wind the clock back, how far back do we have to go? Because, your childhood, you know, the home setting, how was that at a young age?
Again, my childhood was surface level anyway, secure. You know, it was actually at the time, it's funny, there was my mother, there was her mother, and there was her mother. So the first 9 years of my life.
Is that a mammy, a grandmammy, and a great-grandmammy?
Yeah. So
wow.
Up until I was about eight, then my great-grandmother died. And that's what was rare, me and I had one brother and one sister. We lived in the family home, so there was... I would have mixed a lot with cousins, uncles, aunts, all that kind of stuff. And my mother then and grandmother mostly rare. I mean, my mother worked all her life. My mother was a lifeguard. She worked in the baths. Everyone on the north side knows my mother.
Eglantine Baths or another one, Mayfield or what?
Churchfield.
Churchfield, okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm making you out to be much older than you actually are. My apologies, Scott. So there was a lot of maternal love then.
Yeah. So I had that. Like I had the maternal thing. I had that. But there was no male figure. There was no positive male figure. There was no male direction. You know. There was no father in the picture.
Yeah.
And I really felt that. I really felt that lack. So my childhood was fairly safe and around. Physical violence and stuff like that. Now, I would have seen stuff growing up, you know, due to violence and alcoholism and stuff, and especially outside the door in younger years, you know, and you start getting more exposed to the streets, like once you start going out at 7 or 8, 9 and 10 years of age.
When you started to do that, when you started to venture out and get a little bit of independence, what did you see on those streets of the north side or in your city, and how did it influence you?
Well, at the start, it was fine because, look, I was buried in sport and I was very successful in sport. So out at the street, it was just your usual stuff, like being young boys, you're hanging around together. It's just being rough, getting into stupid fights, even with your own friends and things like that. Now, I was very highly sensitive, you know. I remember that I didn't like the feeling of fear. I didn't know what to do with it, and I used to get very overwhelmed by it, make me very uncomfortable, and it used to make me internalise it, and I'd get very, very angry at myself and hate myself for being so afraid. So then once I hit, then as I was getting older, like 11, 12, 13, you had the lads that are drinking around the place, you had the lads that are in the rob cars, the burn cars, the criminal damage, the hairy fellas, the fellas are afraid of, that you feel like there's a bit of fear there when you're in their presence and stuff like that. And they're getting attention then from the girls.
But you know, found that exciting, though?
Oh, very, very. At the start, again, I still had that fear piece, but there was something that drew me to it, you know?
Okay.
And we were all still in a group that, like, we were all growing up together. There was nothing very damaging happening, you know? There was drugs around, you know? But at the time, it was hash and weed, and fellas were drinking, and it all seemed like just normal, really, you know.
But there was drugs, as in hash. There was drink at a young age. There was petty crime, which I'm assuming was robbing and shoplifting. There was robbing cars, joyriding, burning the cars out. Did you actively participate in all that?
Not at the start, no.
Okay.
But I'd be, as I got older, I'd be in the company of people that were doing that stuff.
Right. And did you admire them?
Yeah, part of me did, yeah. It was cool, like.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? And I took to the violent part more than the Robin and all these things because it just didn't naturally come up for me. Like, oh, I want to get into Robin. I want to teach this or teach that. It was more the excitement stuff, you know, and what I say after being exposed to young was like, this group of lads are fighting with this group of lads. And I remember I was young at the time, so I wouldn't have been involved with the fighting, but there would have been older lads that I would have hung around with, like, you know.
Okay. How long ago are we talking here now?
It was 14.
So how old are you now?
35.
So it's 15, 16, 17 years ago.
Yeah, 21 years ago.
21 years ago. Were there organized gang fights, was it?
No. It's just like, look, these are your things. Like, these boys are from up the road. They're around on a weekend. Things kick off. And then it turns into an ongoing thing, like, you know. But it was the stories of it, the excitement of it. Like, oh, this fella gave it to that fella the other night. This fella's fared around the place. But the boys ran him out of it and they gave him a beating and all that. And I used to love it, like. Something in me craved that. And, you know, my own family, you know, my uncles and stuff like that used box, and my mother tried to keep me away from that. She didn't want us involved in violence.
Yeah.
And I was meant to be part of that sport. I joined Thai boxing when I was 14.
Right.
So I left swimming. I was a competitive swimmer. I was Irish champion from the age of 9 to 14. And I left that sport. And my environment had a big impact on that decision because I was the only swimmer, and even though I'd so much success and my trajectory was I wanted to go to the Olympics, I actually felt different and left out because of that, even though it was a positive thing, and I had this deep sense of wanting to belong, you know, tied in with the no father around that, knowing my place, I was feeling alone.
Yeah.
So that moved in, I joined Thai boxing, my older brother, he's 7 years older.
So you gave up the opportunity to perhaps medal at the Olympics though?
Well, I wouldn't say a medal, but
it's a possibility.
Yeah. And it was everything back then to me. I loved this. It gave me my mind at the time, you know, I was underdeveloped and stuff. Like,
yeah.
It was when I got sense of love. Like, that's what I linked it up with, you know, like when I was winning and when I was good at something, that's what got me attention and that's what got me love. I didn't have any inherent value for just being who I am, it always depended on what I could do.
Yeah, okay. As if you needed to always achieve to prove. So the Thai boxing is a form of kickboxing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah,
so then that's what you took up, and you got good at that, I believe. Yeah. Did that become a status symbol for you then?
Oh, I tell you now, Neil, that was like, that started filling in these deficiencies that I had. Like, you know, next thing, like, I was big for my age. The swimming contributed to that. So I was a big young fella. I started filling out my teens. And then I was learning how to fight and learning how to defend myself. And what I found was that I had power. I had power in my punches and stuff. And I was able to damage full-grown men. And I was a kid.
In the ring, no, of course.
In the ring.
The problem became when you started doing it outside of the ring, was it?
Yeah. So what happened was I had this low self-esteem with an inflated, monumental ego started to develop. And then it started happening on the street. So I was partaking in the violence. I was getting involved in the weekend drinking. I was loving the attention, the excitement, the people telling you the stories of what you've done in the weekend, people wanting to be around you. There was a lot of attention from it, and it was addictive. It was very addictive for me. And over the next 2 years, yes, I was getting better at Thai boxing. Yes, I was winning fights, but I was really drawn to the streets and how quickly, I mean, you can fight in the streets 3 or 4 times a week and you have to train 6 to 8 weeks for a fight in the ring. So that mad kind of thinking was like, I just fight out in the street.
And the endorphins and the adrenaline was running, and, you know, you were craving more of it. You were the man to be admired, the man to be feared, the man to be respected on the streets, right?
Yeah, and there was an addiction thing to it. Like, there was you're going from the fella that doesn't want to go somewhere because you're afraid of the fear you feel yourself of being around certain people, and now you're the one that you want, that I wanted people to be afraid because I'm there.
So, you know? Would you just randomly pick fights then?
At the time, I would have. Like, it got that way because I began to associate then as well. You know, you find your click, like, and, you know, I had very good friends, but I started to lean towards palling with fellas that were on the trajectory I was, you know. Then it becomes a thing, like, where it's like anyone, you know, if you're in the painting business or the electrical business, you know all the other painters and electrical people. Yeah. Well, it's like that on the street. Like, you know, when you're into what you're doing, you get to know others that are into what you're doing. So you fight with them. You know, it's just like you'll bump into other groups, you'll kick off fights, you'll start fights, or your friend is fighting, so you'll jump in for him. All that camaraderie stuff came in. So even when you didn't really want to be involved, you got involved, or you were kind of a bit of a disgrace, like, amongst your peers.
Okay. What did the Thai Boxing Club do about when the, do they hear about this carry on?
Well, my coach at the time, like, he's the positive male figures in my life always came from sport. That's all I had. So first it was the swimming. My swimming coaches were men. And then in the Thai boxing, like, Craig, he was a fantastic man. And he always looked out for me and looked for my best. But, like, being responsible too, he taught me, like, there's kids now, Scott, coming in behind you and they look up to you, like, and this is what's happening out here. So you can't come down here anymore, like, unless you want to get your life together. So I was gone from Thai boxing, and every time I made an attempt to change, he would allow me back. It would last a few weeks or a few months, and then I'd be gone again, obviously, because I'd get into the same thing. So that was gone. That bit of stability and support out of my life was
wasn't
gone.
Helped by the drink either, I would imagine, was it? Or were you on other substances besides that?
Drink was the main driver. I messed around with other stuff, especially when I got older. You know, cocaine would have came into it later, but it was never my thing. Like, you know, it was never.
And when did you come on the radar of the guards?
At about, first it was about 16, 17. Like, they would have been around because of the area. They would have been around, you know, there was some random searches and things like that, and we would have been hanging around. But, like, and then let's say when like bonfire nights, all these nights, you know, they'd be around, you'd be taking chase, things like that. But it was around 17, 18, kind of coming under the radar for specifics, like, you know, like being involved in violence and they're coming around. And then at about 19, I would have made my first trip to prison.
Okay, why was that?
Assaults, minor assaults at the start. It was actually, I was in on remand the first few times I was in prison. Like, remand is like when you have charges pending.
Yeah.
So I would have having charges pending, and I would have, let's say, breaking bail, going in remand, back out, back in.
So as a 17-year-old, were you on the Rathmore Road then?
No, my first time was at 19, and that
19.
Was on Rathmore Road, yeah.
Okay, okay. Yeah. So your mother and your grandmother's heart must have been broken.
Look, Neil, that's the tough part of these things. They're the things I have to face, like, in the end, is that, like, you know, this thing for me got so addictive. Like, in my mind, I went to the place, like, I'm bad, like, I'm an evil person, I'm a bad person, and I'm going to die in my 20s, and that's okay, like, and my reputation, like, I remember my mother, like, you know, I know I'm on air, but I remember my mother, like, many times, like, she didn't sleep for years, and just roaring, crying, like, just, would you please stop, like, and I'd feel it, because I am that sensitive, I'd feel it, and I'd bury it down, and I'd go back out the door again, because I wanted to save face. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. So you thought at 19 or whatever that you were going to die in your 20s, and you said you were okay with that.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Okay. I want to pick up on prison after the break. Talking with Scott Kelly. Hang in there. Text 0868104106. Talking with Scott Kelly. What was prison like as a 19-year-old?
I knew the boys in there at the time, if I'm being honest. Like, I knew a few lads in there, and happy to see them. They're happy to see me, and it was like just an extension of what was going on out on the street, really.
Were these some of the lads you grew up with, for instance?
No, they would have been lads I met through the lifestyle, like, you know, at that time.
Yeah. Yeah.
And look, I was just thinking about that there as well on the break. You know, it's that togetherness when you're in it, you know, like you feel like you're in it and you're on the streets together, and not living on the streets together, but you're on the streets together, you're the culture at the time, you know, a lot of these fellas I was with as well were coming from broken homes, and there's like that, the brotherhood, the camaraderie, you're drinking together, you're fighting together, you're suffering together, you're, you know, there's that element. And I had friends as well, like, you know, a lot of lost young, people passing away, people taking their own lives. And instead of a wake-up call from it, it more drove me down the road of, like, what's the point, and not being able to handle
it. It's total chaos, isn't it? Absolute chaos all around you.
Yeah.
But, like, okay, so there might have been camaraderie and reputation mattered to you and respect mattered to you on the streets and what have you. But now you're in jail and the door locks and your freedom is taken away. What do you do all day in prison?
Well, the prison structure, to me, was something I was able to slide into, and that I think that's because of the sporting background. Was because, like, earlier in my life, I was regimented, like, you know, you go training and this time, that time, and do all that. So, at the moment, then in prison, it was like, get up, have your breakfast, come out in the morning time, you know, go to the gym, maybe in the afternoon, you're getting your dinner, then you come back, year time, or not in court prison, that wasn't available until I was doing a proper sentence, but up the country it's more access to schools, access to workshops. So I liked the regime, I liked the structure of knowing where I was going to be and what I was going to be doing every day. I didn't take full advantage of that until the second kind of half of my sentence I was doing at the time. I used it in my favour, but besides, look, let's be honest as well, you're in prison, like, you're in prison. Anything can be a potential threat. You're always in fight or flight. I was so used to fight or flight, I didn't know I was in it. It became my norm.
Okay, but how many times were you in prison?
3 or 4 times.
And was each case worse than the last?
Yeah, well, as I said, the first few times were like a small sentence and then remand sentences. And then the longer one, my last sentence, was a 4.5-year sentence for assault.
That must have been a bad assault, was it?
It was three section three assaults, which is assault causing harm.
And were they just randomers or what?
So one of them was an ongoing thing, and two of the other cases were fights that broke out on a weekend with people that I didn't know.
Because, you know, with Thai boxing and kickboxing, like, you are in possession of a lethal weapon, really, aren't you?
Yeah.
So you're in jail for what? Did you say a 4-year stretch for that, was it?
Yeah. So I was, I got handed something like, it's jail time works the way the sentences, you know, I got handed out like something like 6 years or 6.5 years, but the way it was ran together, it was a 4.5-year sentence.
Is there any kind of mortification or embarrassment or shame, you know, for you yourself or for your family?
At the time there was, but I didn't have the capacity to be able to face it and deal with it.
Right, okay.
So I was like, I don't know, I was like, I was very kind of consumed with this identity, like, of the black sheep that I was after taking in the family, you know what I mean? My mindset was very warped, you know?
Is it a danger? Is it like, are you 5 to a cell, people sleeping in mattresses, or was, you know, is that where we're at now, but not then?
No, there was a few prisons, all right, it was like in a 4-man cell. My first stint to prison was like a 2-man cell, but I was the 3rd man, so you're on a mattress on the floor. That was the old cock prison.
Is it a dangerous place?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It is, like. You know, prison is prison, and you have people coming into prison. I mean, there's people in prison, let's say, like, that should be more in a mental
health
by a hospital, you know?
Yeah.
So you have all that going on. You have people fighting with people. You have drugs coming into, if drugs come into a prison, you know, that's going to cause erratic behaviour. You have people coming in that people you might have been fighting with on the outside. So, like, prison's prison, like, it's what it says on the tin, like, you know?
So, were there weapons in the prison?
There is. There's contraband in all prisons.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? There is.
And would vendettas be settled in prisons?
Yeah, you'd see it all the time.
So you're on alert all the time while you're in there, then, because you've hurt a lot of people, like.
Well, that's it. Like, you know, you you went to jail, and it's like, okay, what's every time the gate, like let's say you're out in the yard, especially to start, you're out in the yard, the door opens, someone fresh is coming in. Everyone's looking. Who is it? Like, is there someone I'm arguing with? Is there someone that's arguing with me? Do I need to be on the lookout? So that's always going on, you know?
Do you have to find your tribe in prison, you know? Do you have to find your group and stick with them?
Well, everyone's different. You know, like, you'd see fellas coming in, like, I mean, they could be from a different county. They made a mistake some night, or they're probably alcohol-related, like, as in suffering from alcoholism, petty stuff, and they're on their own. You see fellas in prison, it's very sad. Like, they're on their own, they have nothing. They're just existing, really. Like, you know what I mean? And then you'd have tribes in prison too. Like, you know, you'd have people, like I said, that are from the same areas, from the same gangs, messed up in the same life.
So when did the penny drop then, where you said, listen, I don't want to be doing this anymore. I've been to jail numerous times. This is a 6-year stretch, serving 4. I got to do something about this.
It was about halfway in, like it was about 18 months in, kind of thing. And my prison time was grand. Like, you know, like, actually it wasn't. Look, people belonged to me close, the grandmother that reared me. My best friend all died when I was in prison. So there was the real helplessness and hopelessness of that, and the heartbreak. I wasn't a big disruptive prisoner. I was in a few prison fights. I had all that stuff. I had no real thing to change. I had no motivation to change. I had bits of times in the cell where I was saying, what's it all about? What should I do? No. But it was never really like a huge lifestyle change. It happened when I was in the Midlands prison, which is up in Portlaoise. I was up there and we were on a landing, and on the landing there was a lot of Cork lads at the time. And one of the Cork lads was, he's about 10 years older than me, and I knew him from the area, and he was well respected in that circle, like, if you know what I mean. And he's well known, and he was doing very well for himself. And I would have admired him. And I started beginning to speak to him. We go out and we do laps in the yard. We'd be talking. He'd tell me about what he's doing in the school. He's telling me about the changes he's trying to make in his life. And it really, do you know what? I was having, as I said, I lacked masculinity. I lacked healthy masculinity.
You're getting a kind of a father figure there, aren't you?
Exactly. Yeah. And that's what I took him as. Now, he had the same issues I had. It's just he was older and he was manly, and I listened to him and I respected what he had to say. And I just started, look, I'll do that as well, and I'll go to the school as well, and I speak to him man to man, and I was getting so much from the relationship. Yeah. Like, looking back now, it really, really supported me.
Yeah.
And it gave me trust into, like, you know what, I'm going to have a crack off this, because it's very hard to change when your environment reflects everything you're trying to change from.
Yeah, but two environments, the one you came from, the one you now find yourself incarcerated in. Absolutely. Yeah. I'm gonna just finish this conversation with the other side of 11. I'll only keep you 4 or 5 minutes, Scott. I hope you're okay with that. I just don't want to rush it, because it's an incredibly interesting and impressive turnaround in your life. And I want to get more of that after 11, okay? Appreciate it.
Yeah.
Back after 11, text 0868-104-106. Your thoughts are welcome. Talking with Scott Kelly, won't keep him much longer. So we know that you're in and you have a role model that you look up to and respect and admire. You end up devouring the books. You did your equivalent to the junior cert, I think, and studied psychology, took up mindfulness, all this in jail.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So you were on the road to recovery, right? 3.5 years later, okay, after the sentence, you're released. What's the feeling when you know the day has come that you're leaving prison?
It's a mixture. You're excited because you're going home, and also I was aware enough and conscious enough of the challenges that faced me when I went home.
Were you welcome home?
Amongst my peers, I was, amongst all friends. You know, I think it's very important to mention as well, like, my neighbours, where I'm from, like, never once did they turn me away. Like, they always accepted me, remembered who I was when I was young, and, like, oh, you know, all that going for me when I came home. Do you know what I mean? People really gave me a chance, like.
And in the house with your mam?
Yeah, they were on board. You know, them being in jail kind of gave space and time to mend those relationships. You know, I used to love writing letters. I used to love ringing home, like, to say what I'm doing in the school and I'm progressing. You know, obviously there was the fear with them, you know, but like, it's wanting you changing and wanting to change. That doesn't mean everyone outside is going to accept and want and care. Do you know what I mean?
Well, they could have seen the violence of your life, the hurt caused and the pain and the fights and the robbing. And, you know, some people wouldn't get past that, I suppose, you know?
And look, there are hurdles like you have to face. Like, you know, it's like, am I going to leave, number one, am I going to leave my own past define what I'm going to do from here on?
I know that.
And number two, am I going to let other people's opinions, even if they're valid opinions, also stop me from developing and moving on?
Are there some prisoners that it's when they come out, there's almost a sense of pride of having done time?
Of course it is. Here you get fellas there by they've done 2 weeks prison and they get out as if they're flipping Al Capone. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it's the image, it's the culture, like, it's a notch on the belt, you know, it's all that kind of stuff. Like, it's part of the lifestyle, you know.
But in spite of everything, during that stint in the Midlands, the old life pulled you back in again.
It did, and it came. Do you know what it came, right? And it, looking back, it pushed me further down the road I needed, in the sense of what I needed to work on within myself. I still hadn't developed the capacity to deal with relational stuff and deal with heavy emotions. And I had personal things going on, and it was got to do with relationships. It was the breakdown of my old life as well. So I started kind of getting into trouble with fellas I used to pal around with.
So the drinking started again and the violence started. So,
yeah, it did. And for about a period of 6 months, it nearly got worse than it did than the years leading into prison. And I was suicidal at 12, 13 was my first time having suicidal ideation. It was back when I was 25, 26. And what kept me going, the only reason I didn't kill myself is because I was fighting with other people and I wouldn't give them the sort of it. That was where my mind was.
There's a lot of confusion in there, I have to say.
Big time. And thankfully, what happened was, like, you know, I just for one day, there was chaos. I was gone from the family. I was living there. I was staying in the streets. I was staying in the fella's couch another few days of the week. And what happened was, it was an internal thing. You know, I really find it hard to articulate as well these days, that it was like I felt the odds were so stacked against me that I nearly created a goal out of it, that I was like, I'm going to bounce back from this. Like, I'm expected here to kill someone or to be killed or to kill myself. And I'm going to prove that wrong.
Yeah, because there was a high chance of either or. Yeah, for sure there was.
Extremely high chance, yeah. And
so did you have to leave all of that part of your life and all of those people and kind of disengage or cancel all of that from your life?
I did, and over time, you know, like, it was realizing what needs to go, realizing what supported me to get from A to B is not going to support me from getting B to C.
Yeah, but how do you do that? You have nowhere to live. You have no money. They talk about step down and rehab, not being there to help people who want to change their lives off prison, and they get dragged back. How do you do that when you have no tools to work with?
I had savings at the time, right? And what happened was, a couple of nights of the week at the time, I was able to put myself up in a B&B. And then there was a fellow who I knew from Thai boxing who was very kind to me. And the days that his daughter wasn't staying in his apartment, he'd let me sleep there.
Right. Did you? And did you go on then to, that got you started, did you do your Leaving Cert?
Yeah, so I done that actually within the first few months when I came out of prison.
Right.
So I got out of prison and continued straight with the education, back Thai boxing, doing all the healthy things. And then I got a period where all that fell apart.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then coming back out of that period, then again, I started rebuilding relationships, trust built. I was able to go back home. I got a job. I was attending meetings around alcoholism and stuff like that at the time.
Okay.
I
I know I'm bombarding you, but we hear a lot of people who come out or get out early or don't go into jail, they get a thing called community service. You did that. What is that?
Well, I done community, so I was released on an early scheme to do college and community service. At the time, I was up in the orthopaedic, and we were doing the groundwork up there. We were making kindling up there. We were digging out for fresh trees up there. You could be scrubbing paint, graffiti off walls.
So that's a real thing. People actually do the community service, do they?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I was always curious. So I didn't know exactly what was done. Could be anything then.
Yeah.
Yeah. And where are you at now?
So, yeah, now is fantastic. You know what I mean? Like, I don't really identify. Like, I'm having this conversation with you now, Neil, right? Neil, but, like, that's not who I am. Like, that part of me, like, it's not that I disregard it or anything like that. I've worked through it. I've felt it. I've realised the damage I've done to people. Like, to feel those hurts and pains has been extremely difficult. It's been extremely difficult leaving the identity go.
Yeah.
Especially when you're met with younger versions of yourself that are giving you the dark stare, that are giving you the cocky look, that are like, without saying anything, as if like challenging, you know, and to see my own responsibility in that and my own thought process behind this and to own it, you know.
So you look at the youngsters now and you see, that was me.
Oh, I can see that big time. I can see how lost they are. I can see where they'd get addicted. You know, I can see they're in the crazy lifestyle, but I can see what they're getting out of it.
And would it be the case in many cases, I don't mean to generalise, but do you think that in many, many of those cases, there's no father figure?
Either there's none or there's a dysfunction kind of one. Because like, it's very hard to expect a man or woman to come from dysfunctional upbringing and suddenly become very functional adults and parents.
It doesn't work that way. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. So like the big thing for me was that I didn't have that. Now, I don't blame everything on that, nor do I need the external father today to fix that. I got those qualities met, as I said, like, let's say with Timmy in prison, that man, like, he met qualities in me that I was lacking.
Do you have kids yourself?
Yeah, I've boys now, and like, the biggest thing in my life now is the blessing it is to be the thing that I never had. Like, to be a dad, like, it's just the best thing in the world, you know, and it's the hardest thing in the world, but it's the biggest mirror. It's like the crucifix of change, like, or the crucible, like, the, you know, it's the mirror back to you, especially my younger fellow who's four. Like, he mirrors back my needs, my boundaries, my limits, my capacities, what I need to work on, what I lacked and what I didn't receive will kind of show up in the relationship with him.
Yeah, you're clearly showing up because you speak passionately about him now. But do you mind them very closely? Will you overparent as a consequence of what happened to you?
I'm aware of that there. That's there, like, because of what I was exposed to, you know. But I make it very, if you asked me years ago, I'd be like, oh, my sons now, they're going straight into boxing and Thai boxing. They have to do it. They have to be this, watch out for that. It's not like that no more. They can be free. I think everyone should learn some bit of self-defense, because it does give great confidence to know that if something happens, I can defend myself.
Not if you have anger management problems, though.
Well, look, definitely, I see where you're coming from that, but that's the guidance and discipline as well, you know?
Okay.
I mean, a big confidence for me in changing my life as well was knowing that if something comes back around, if something comes up now from 20 years ago, I can at least handle myself. You know?
Yeah, and before I let you go, you also show that you can fail and fail and fail numerous times, but it doesn't mean you're always going to fail. You know, someday the door will open and improvements will be made in life. Does that involve apology, though? I wonder, you know, you hear of, you know, the consequences of our actions and making right. Was there ever any of that?
Definitely. All these things, like, they build, like, they're character building. You need the struggles, you need the failings, as you were just saying. The apology comes in a way that, to make amends, you have to be, it's a very skillful thing to do, and it's going to be different every time, because approaching someone or making amends in a certain way could actually do more damage than good.
Well, what way did that happen to you? Did you approach someone to apologise?
Yeah, so I've been around people that I would have harmed in the past, and we would have conversations, and I apologise and I explain my case. Sometimes that has come back in a very receptive way, you know, it's been received, and then other times it's just been like a nod of the head, like, you know, or I can feel the coldness, and that's okay too.
Is the nod of the head a rejection?
I could feel it as a rejection, you know. I also have to understand that that person has only their capacity as well. Maybe they're not in a place to forgive. Maybe they don't want to forgive. Maybe,
yeah, you can. You know? Well, you can. You know, it's something that is exclusively their right to give. And if they don't, it's because they're not past whatever happened. But at the same time, it's a brave move to apologize. I'll give you that.
Yeah, and look, it's a thing as well that I don't believe you can fake. Do you know what I mean? Like, for me, like, I want to do things because I mean them. Like, do I genuinely feel it? You know what I'm saying?
Right. What do you do? What do you do for coin now?
Okay, so at the moment I'm doing coaching. Like, it's kind of life coaching. That's one of the elements I do. I do talks around resilience. So I go into companies and give talks around stress. I do groups and one-to-ones around meditation and mindfulness. That was a major part of my journey, is the meditation and mindfulness and self-inquiry stuff around emotions, core beliefs. I'm also in training as a craniosacral therapist. So it's, again, got to do with the body, the nervous system and regulation and how to deal with things. So I'm building a portfolio. I'm enjoying it. I'm back swimming. I'm racing. I'm just living life, Neil. You know, I think that alone is enough. Like, you don't need to speak to it. I actually don't want to be out on the radio and on papers. These things just happen.
Yeah, no, I love talking to inspirational people who have had dark backgrounds or, you know, issues in their lives and come off the tracks on a number of occasions, but managed to turn it around. And I wish you and your family the best in the whole wide world. It's an inspirational story, and I'm really glad you shared it. Thank you, Scott.
I appreciate that. Thanks very much.
Look after yourself. Bye-bye. Take care. Bye-bye. Your thoughts on that, text 0868 104 106. An awful lot to unpack there. Not just his life story, actually, but I think maybe a reflection of our communities and our neighbourhoods. It could be anywhere, anytime, depending on your upbringing. I have to say, needless to say, it goes without saying, there are plenty of one-parent families that function perfectly well, thank you very much. An awful lot of mums are doing it on their own. An awful lot of dads are doing it on their own. But it's the consequential issue when it's not working out, and when the child has issues, or the groups or the peers that they turn to, that, you know, who am I to disagree with Scott saying he missed that from his life and it could have made all of the difference. Text 0868 104 106. Back after the break.